Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Lawrence Gowan of Styx. The group has just released its 18th studio album, Circling From Above, and it's the first to feature new bassist Terry Gowan, brother of Lawrence. In addition to releasing this new LP, Styx is on the road with Don Felder and the Kevin Cronin Band throughout the summer of 2025 on the Brotherhood of Rock Tour. And Styx is performing the classic 1977 LP, The Grand Illusion, in its entirety. Gowan, who was an established solo artist in Canada before joining Styx, recently spoke with us about the new record, the power of analog recordings, and how music can inspire people in all walks of life. That's Lawrence Gowan of Styx on Into Music, coming up now. It's like 11:30 in the morning and you're already nattily dressed.
I'm well, you know, that's the thing. When you do these Zoom calls, you kind of got to get stage ready first thing in the morning. So it's like, it's a good incentive to kind of, brush my teeth and comb my hair.
Right on. Well, it's great to be talking to you about this record. And Styx has been on a roll with new music over the last several years. This is no exception. I mean, after the last record, did you know immediately, like, hey, we want to go in and we want to strike while the iron's hot, do another one?
I think there's quite a bit to that, honestly, Jed, because the last record on Billboard, now they have a rock album chart. Except, you know, they've divided everything up into genres, and we got to number one with Crash of the Crown. And the moment we saw that, we started jumping up and down and realizing this means we're going to get to make another record. Universal have come back into the recording picture with Styx ever since 2015, I believe it was. In 2017, we put our first record with them, and they have the whole catalog. So, you know, with the mission and then, you know, working through the next few years and coming up with Crash of the Crown and then realizing, yeah, as you just said, we're kind of on a roll. We have a really good songwriting kind of little cabal with Tommy Shaw and Willie Vankovich and myself. And so we kind of, you know, ideas just began to percolate very quickly after Crash of the Crown. And then we just had to, basically the biggest challenge was finding the time to do it in amongst 100 shows a year, or 92, I think we did last year. But we did, you know, we carved it out. And, I went and spent quite a bit of time in Nashville, and we did writing sessions and recording sessions. And then we brought the other guys in. Todd, of course, nailed his stuff in a few days, my brother, Terry, this would be the first album he's on, Circling From Above. So very strong lineup. JY sings one song on the record, and he gave his JY signature to all kinds of things. And Chuck, of course, he plays on one piece as well.
The writing thing was going to be my other question, because presumably all three of you are writing for various other reasons at other times, but this sounds like it is really a dedicated focus. Like, this is time to work on Styx music.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Honestly, since I've joined the band, you know, in 26 years now, every idea is potentially a Styx idea, you know, the reality is that of every 10 ideas, you might get a fraction of one in there, because everyone else, we mash our bits together, our best bits together, you know, and that's how the songs are written. And then, of course, we brainstorm the lyrical content of it as well. I think there's one song on the record that Tommy, I believe, wrote completely on his own, and there's two songs that Will wrote on his own, or one or two, and so they have those, and there's and the other six or so is the three of us. Yeah, or no, one of them was just Will and I. So anyway, it's like that. But there's ideas all the time that are kind of there. sometimes you think this is the championing idea and it falls by the wayside, and something else that has been around for a few months suddenly pokes its head back up again, which was the case with Build and Destroy, for example.
I've always wondered this, if it's kind of necessary to maybe sometimes have somebody who's, for lack of a better term, kind of like a fly in the ointment, somebody who says, that's good, but wait up. Let's try this.
That's an excellent way to put it, quite honestly, because that happens all the time. The ultimate arbiter, you know, if in this type of thing, is really the producer, right? And it so happens that Will Ivankovich is the producer. He came in as the producer, right? We only made him, you know, he was anointed a full band member after we did the mission, and we would have him on stage to go through those songs. He'd come up almost like a special guest, mainly to make sure that everyone had all the pieces intact and that he was adding that extra flavor. But, you know, after Crash of the Crown, we realized, no, we're going to need this guy on stage for an awful lot of the show. And now it's to the point where, yeah, we need him on every song. So, but he wears the other hat. He wears the producer's hat and then decides what's going to happen there. Also, quite frankly, the originals in the band, let's call it that, the guys that have been there for, you know, 40 to 50 years, put it that way, or 50 years plus in the case of JY and Chuck, they also have to give a kind of a stamp of approval to something. You know, they have to kind of go, yeah, this fits well. I'm digging this. I like where this has gone. Otherwise, it can fall by the wayside, or maybe another little bit of that will emerge later on down the road.
One thing too with this record and the last two is that there is this kind of continued evolution of Styx. I mean, Styx is not one band. If you look at the earliest music and so on and so forth, there's been that evolution and that continues. That's going to be exciting for you as a musician to see that.
Yes, it is. I mean, I've said many times in the past, the band that you see today on stage, we're the culmination of the efforts of everyone that's ever been in the band. It is a continuum that began in 1972. And so it to my mind, you know, John Panozzo and Dennis DeYoung and Glenn Burtnick and Ricky Phillips, they're all still kind of part of, and John Sirluski, you know, they're all still part of what built this to where it is today, you know, devoid of any of the backstage drama that went down before I joined anyway. it is part of it. And it speaks to, you know, I love watching interviews with some of my, you know, heroes. And I remember reading one back before this was invented, reading one back in 1990 with Rick Wakeman. And they asked him, I think it was Melody Maker or something. They asked him something like, does it bother you when other members come into Yes periodically and then you come back, et cetera? And he said, his answer was so succinct. He just kind of said, why would that bother me? He said, Yes is like, it's like, he says, 200 years ago, there was a London Symphony and they played Beethoven. And today there's a London Symphony and they play Beethoven. And all the original members of the London Symphony have long since left the planet, as has Beethoven. But they still play modern pieces and they still evolve as an orchestra, et cetera. He said, I think there'll be a Yes 100 years from now. And I remember at the time reading that and thinking, oh, no, 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 you've lost the plot. it has to be these guys. And then I realized, well, it hasn't just been those guys already. It's evolved, and Genesis evolved, and Van Halen evolved. And, you know, I can keep going. There are so many bands that have had to face the realities of life. And in order for that band's kind of trajectory to continue, new people have had to come in. So I fall under that category where Styx is concerned, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know. It's not to take this away from Styx, but late last year, I went to see Discipline, which is the, you know, the 80s King Crimson era. And it's just Adrian Belew and Tony Levin, neither of them original to King Crimson, Steve Vai and Danny Carey, but they're playing that music that I never got to see live. And it's like, well, this is beautiful. This is everybody wins.
Yeah, I know. You're like, I always wanted to hear Elephant Talk live, and now you get a chance to. Yeah, I Tony Levin is not only did he become a friend very early on when he was started making out my first solo album, my second solo album, Strange, that we made back in 1984, but he's also kind of a, it's not a mentor because he's not that kind of person. He's more like a in some ways he's like a North Star to me as to how to be a great musician that can play with so many different players and still have this authentic delivery that comes across no matter what he's doing, if he's playing with Paul Simon or if he's playing with King Crimson or Peter Gabriel, of course, or even with me. There's something that just it's he turns it into such a joy. And I'd say that Styx fall under that category today. There's such a joy in what we do, and it's palpable to the audiences that come and see us and those that still enjoy the records.
One thing with this record I absolutely love is just the sonic quality of it. Everything is so clear, and it's not. I think there was a period of time, maybe in the 90s, where I felt like a lot of records kind of got overstuffed. You know, it's like throw this in there, throw this in here. And it's like this record, it's like, oh, the instruments breathe.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I think one of the great things when Will came in is that he has, it's beyond an affinity for the analog age. He really has, he's galvanized to it. And as so many younger people have fallen in love with that classic rock sound, you know, when they hear Led Zeppelin or they hear Queen or the Beatles or whatever, it became apparent that the dividing line of when the digital age came in, it of course brought so many great things. I mean, it always sounds like, you know, whenever you bring this up, it sounds like you're being disparaging of it, and I'm not. It's just that I'm trying to think of a good analogy for it. It's just that it was at odds with how the early records were made, how those classic rock records were made. Analog equipment has a completely different, it adds a completely different flavor to the sound that digital sound just doesn't do. You know, they're getting better at it, by the way. There are so many plugins now and so many digital version knockoffs of what the analog gear used to do. So they're mimicking a previous era with digital stuff, and it's getting better and better, which is fantastic. But we use as many of the clunky machines as we possibly can in the making of this record, and so often that breeds what exactly what you referred to. There's an openness because one instrument can eat up a way more space than it can in the digital realm. We don't even know. I don't even understand why that is. I had one, technical person explain to me. I gave a good analogy of it, but I just know that the when it all comes together in a band sound, if you want to recreate that classic rock sound, which we endeavor to do, you need to embrace those clunky, I'll use that word again, old ways of doing it and enjoy it basically and embrace it is what I'm trying to say. So, you know, there are fantastic B3 organ plugins, et cetera, that you can use and modules, et cetera. I use one of them live. But when we're recording the record, no, it has to be the big giant B3 with the proper Leslie and the proper mics and going to the proper tape machine or what, all of the on through these compressors. You have to go through all those steps. But where that eventually leads you is to a record that sounds like these last three records sound like, which, you know, we put them up against, we take Circling from Above, for example. We'll take that and we'll immediately put on Pieces of Eight, which is right from that era and perfectly sticks thing. And if we feel there's too much of a bump, so to speak, in the sound or differentiation, we stop basically and try to figure out what is it that we have to do in order for this to sound like it resonates with that era. Not that it's from that era, but it resonates with that era. And it's particularly younger people that have come to the band now, people say under 40 and weren't born in the classic rock era. They're the ones I think that really notice this. They notice that, oh, that's that sound. That's that sound that comes together in that manner.
I also think about records being a product of the space that you're in. There are two examples. One is Speaking of Yes earlier, I've heard Bill Bruford say, you know, you have to remember that sometimes we would tear down our gear, go off, play a gig, come back, and put it all together. You might not remember, you know, the exact mic placement. So you get this differentiation. And I also think about the band, how you can hear them as the Hawks. And somehow when they went to New York and they're playing in that house, something changed, you know? That environment refined the music itself.
I agree. I fully agree with that. I mean, we've made these last two albums. Well, Crash the Ground was made in separate cities, but all came together ultimately in Nashville. This record was made in Nashville. And yes, all of us being in the room together, that and the room itself, it does breed idiosyncrasies that the kind of pristine world of digital recording doesn't offer. It gives you a pristine reflection of what you're doing, but there's something about that's a great observation, where the mics are placed and how the sound subtly shifts from one section to the next, and your ear doesn't immediately detect that, but something in the vibration of it, let's call it that, you know, that get a bit cosmic, shifts. You're right. Yeah, that's great. I've never heard that before, but yeah, of course that would happen.
Now, you've also made this an album meant to be listened to front to back, the way that the music dovetails one to the other, which is also, I think, really, really important that you experience an album as a whole. I feel bad if I have to, for instance, stop playing an album in the middle, get up, answer the door, take the needle off the turntable. You know, like, oh, I'm ruining it.
You know something, Jed, you are right. You are of our tribe because I fully agree. This is one of the great things that I think, you know, and it's going to, again, it sounds like I'm putting it down, and I'm not, because the digital stuff era has been such a boon to live performance. It's I mean, God, you know, a digital piano through a PA system is, to my ear and to my sensibility, it beats the hell out of an acoustic piano because you can make the thing roar through the PA. And with an acoustic piano live, the open mics are going to cause, there's all kinds of havoc, you know, drums are bleeding into them and all kinds of things. Whereas recording, you want to use that real piano and mic the thing up and put it through, or we've gone through that. But the art form of the album, the 40 minutes roughly that it takes to listen from side A to the end of side B, that was a sacrosanct kind of experience that we had growing up. And that was definitely, in some ways, just flat out destroyed with the digital age, where we can pick and choose and do. I mean, people, we did mixtapes in the 80s, and those are fun, but it's not the same as delving into a full album and, you know, putting this world aside for a time, and not, it's the most non-scrolling thing that you can do. And I'm a scroller too, by the way. It's like, but listening to an album top to bottom, I mean, so yesterday I had, this morning I started again, but, and I had got interrupted because I had to talk to Jed. But I was, of course, listening to Pet Sounds all the way through and vibing on that whole, you could picture them, those incredible players in the studio, putting these, you know, how these songs came together, how one follows the next, et cetera, which then led me to an expression that I'm going to use a lot now. When people think that a record is a concept record, is this another concept record? That's not what you're hearing. It's not hearing a concept. What you're hearing is a cohesive, that's a better word for it, a cohesive collection of songs. And when you listen to them as a collection of songs, your mind will the little theater of the mind kicks in, and you begin to stitch together a concept, as I do when I listen to Sgt. Pepper, as I did yesterday when I listened to Pet Sounds. And really, that's not it. It's the cohesive arc that starts from the beginning of the record and concludes at the end. And that cohesive arc is there. If I put on Funeral for a Friend, let's say it's the Goodbye Albuquerque Road album, I want to go through four sides and get all the way to harmony in order to really feel that I really experienced it again. And I got all those feelings that I had when I first heard it. And those have all come back to me, and they've And then I apply them to today. And I mean, I'm living to, I mean, I'm not living in the past. I'm living, unless I'm listening to that Jethro Tull album, but then I'm actually living in the past. But yeah, it applies to today. Those songs have come forward in my life and they still have meaning to me. But that album experience, the full arc of, the full trajectory has a, it's such a great form of entertainment and an artistic thing that I more and more people are discovering. So thanks for bringing that up.
Well, and just briefly to touch on this, losing Sly Stone and Brian Wilson in the same week, this was something. And I was just thinking about how both of them were just so instrumental in bringing rock music, to the next level.
Yeah, that's very true.
And it's like, I listen, the weird thing is I listen to the early Sly and the Family Stone records and it's like, oh, there's stuff that wound up in progressive rock here, you know?
100, absolutely. I know you think of Sly Stone, you think of the family Stone and the funk element of it, but you just mentioned Bill Bruford. I mean, that guy's got there's funkiness in his playing, and that's. He's a pure progressive rock guy. So, I know he's jazzy as well, but I mean, we'll forgive that. I love getting in trouble for those kind of statements. So, no, the progressive elements of Sly and the Family Stone, yeah, entirely. That had a much broader effect on what followed than just, I mean, I can hear as much. Disco took as much from that as did progressive rock. I mean, and there's two opposing factions entirely. But yeah, from Sly Stone, yeah, a lot of that came out. Just as so much of what a cohesive, we'll go back to that word, record came out of Pet Sounds. That was probably, I reminded myself it was May of 1966 that that record came out, a full year before Sgt. Pepper. But it's right around the time of the Beatles doing Revolver. And that's where I remember listening to, I was, Revolver was the first album I ever got, top to bottom. It just had a complete, from Taxman all the way to She Said, She Said, I think is the last song. Or is it Tomorrow Never Knows? Oh, shit.
And
They
the
had
capital version or the
Yeah, there's that as well. Yeah, you're right. I know. Because, yeah, the North American version did not have, what was the song? I think it didn't have Eleanor Rigby on it. That's right. Anyway, okay. You guys can Google all that. But yeah, so that affected what albums wound up sounding like after that. It affected, the Moody Blues records and Broken Arrow, etc. Those bands that were the precursor to where progressive rock began. I think so many of them trace those strings who came out of Pet Sounds and from Revolver, I think.
So this is maybe kind of a strange question. I'm guessing that you don't maybe have a ton of time to go out and see other bands when you're not on the road. I wondered if on those occasions when you do, there are times where you see somebody doing something and you get really inspired and you go, oh, that's something I haven't seen on stage before.
True, that does happen. That does happen. There was a period there where, when I'd have brief little, they're brief. I only get to see maybe two or three other concerts a year of other artists. It's usually around two. The most recent one I saw was Genesis with Nick Collins, who I just met just a few days ago, came to our show on drums. And what I discovered there was that here's a band that I've seen since the 1970s. And holy God, their show was so spectacular. It was just like an emotional, incredible thing to witness. And yeah, I would have definitely taken something out of but I used to go and see a lot of metal bands because my son's a metal drummer in a successful metal band out of the United States now. I'd go and see metal acts, and I would see things that they would do on stage that were very kind of extreme, but the way that they threw themselves into it, I thought, oh, I love this. It's not now it's not just one guy, sometimes just the lead singer, but like an entire band that is just very much like what Styx do. I mean, Styx is a collection of front men. That's why the show works so well. I look across the stage and I'm just as entertained as the audience because I'm looking at everybody and they're all, I think we're the most extra, I've said to Tommy, the most extroverted band on the planet. So, yes, I get stuff from new acts all the time.
There's that that element that you're talking about with the personalities that that was another thing I think that is kind of a different time where it's like I remember going to see my uncle's country band when I was a kid. You know, he was the lead singer, but then the bass player would take a song and it was always the funny song, right?
Yeah,
You know,
the John Entwistle song.
yeah. And then the drummer, might do something, the other guitar player, then they come back to the focal point. And so it's like it gives you just, I think, more of a rounded experience of the show.
Much as I love solo artists and being that's where I began in music and I still do that, there's something about suddenly switching it up where another voice comes in. And that's I'll bring it around to this album for a second. One of the things I love in our new record, and we did quite a bit of it in the last two as well, is when the trade-off of vocal happens right within the one song. Like the Crash of the Crown, for example, it starts off with JY, then Tommy kind of takes over, and then I kind of it's handed to me, and then I take this carry the song out. You've got three lead singers in one song, and we have that. There's a song on this album called "Forgive" that Tommy sings the verses that starts with him. And then there's a kind of a handoff, right? At kind of the B verse that leads us into the chorus. And then I take that. And then we have our voices blend on the chorus where we get into the harmonies. Yeah, I love the shifting of the picture like that. I love the kind of, let's keep with the album references. I love the side two of Abbey Road school of it jumps from George to John to Paul and then back and forth and then it ping pongs around like that. Then Ringo gets to sing something. It's that to me is highly entertaining. It's part of why even I like, I'll give you another example. Exile on Main Street, where you hear I think it's side three that starts off with Happy. You get Keith Richards singing. All of a sudden, you've got this fresh flavor comes in, and then back to Mick. And there's something about that handoff that I find really entertaining.
Well, and tonight there'll be some kid who this is they're a budding musician. This is their first concert. They see that happen on stage and they go, aha.
I have a great story about that. About 20, I'm going to say 20 years ago, it's actually probably a little bit more. Yeah, it actually is a bit more. It's more like 22 or 3 years ago. There was a young guy, it was just when social media was getting going, a young guy named Dennis Atlas, who people will know the name now probably, who wanted to be, a keyboard player. And I can't remember exactly how we met, we got in touch. His family was backstage with his parents. He was maybe only about 10 or 11 years old, I'm going to guess at the time. And I met him. He wanted to be a musician. I could see he had the kind of the fire in his eyes, et cetera, with his brother, who was also musically gifted. And, but the following year, he was showing me pictures of him with practicing with his band in the garage. And his dad had built him a spinning keyboard. And and he'd fashioned this thing and he kind of learned to use it and learned to manipulate it. And a few more years went on, and I see that he's got a Styx cover band that I also do like other stuff as well, Journey in Boston, some other things I believe, and they're really good. And then I see another 5 years. I'd see him every year or so, a couple little quick messages back and forth on Facebook. I'd say, way to go, Dennis, you're doing well. And then, there was this disappointing thing where he went out for American Idol, which I have a lot of opinions about, harsh opinions about, and he didn't make the cut. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. This kid's really talented, but he didn't make the cut. But this is typical of that mentality of show business. But then a year went by, and now today you can look him up on YouTube if you like, because he's the keyboard player in Toto, okay, alongside Dave Page. So, they've got two keyboard players. And I look at that and I'm so kind of happy for him. But there's someone that saw what happens at a rock concert And that spark just ignited, you know. And you don't have, this is not to say that you have to become a musician, et cetera, but there's something about that spark that ignites and makes you want to reach for something. And often it happens at a rock con. In my life, it happens at a great rock show that this light bulb comes on. And I've spoken to, you know, I visit NASA quite often. I think I got their pin on right now. Yeah. And, you know, it's so funny how many of these scientific minds that I have no, I can't even approach their level of thinking, were inspired by a band they saw, or Star Trek, or something in the entertainment world that ignited that feeling in them, you know. And it could be, yes, Close to the Edge, or it could be, you know, Styx Grand Illusion, you know. But it's amazing. It doesn't, the walk of life that it carries you forward into, and the inspiration you can garner from that experience is not to be underestimated.
You've been listening to a conversation with Lawrence Gowan of Styx. Styx's latest album, Circling From Above, is out in physical format now and is available from the band's official website, styxworld.com. The album will be available for download and streaming as of July 18th. You can learn more about the band and the album at the aforementioned styxworld.com, and more about Gowan himself at lawrencegowan.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can send us questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find out more about all programming on this station at our website, kmuw.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.